This evening we are looking at session 2, that is chapter 2 of the book of Ecclesiastes. Last week we looked at chapter 1, and in the first 11 verses we learned how the preacher, that is Solomon, mentioned that there is no lasting gain in all our human toiling. You know, no matter whatever you are doing, you are there for a short period of time. And when we also studied the word vanity, is the Hebrew word hebel, which means just a breath. It is all just a breath. It is there. Life goes on, you die. You know, it is just a small breath. And that is what we learned primarily last week. And in verse 8, where we learned that all things are full of weariness. All things are full of weariness. So in this particular chapter, chapter 2, we would learn how he mentions that wisdom, pleasure, work, and possessions are often bubbles that we create to insulate ourselves from reality. And unless that bubble is, you know, poked and it bursts, then only reality sets in. And in this chapter, chapter 2, he will speak about these bubbles. He will also speak about that which will poke that bubble, which will burst it, which is actually death bursts that bubble. So in chapter 2 now, Solomon describes his search through the plains of pleasure, the woods of wisdom, the marsh of madness, and the fields of folly. This is where he roams around, if you were to say. And he says, I want to experience all this and find out if there's some satisfaction in this life. The writer to the Hebrews tells us about Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 9 and 10. By faith he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Now, it is very clear in this passage, in the chapter of faith, that God expects us to be individuals who recognize that we have no permanent roots in this world. We are only pilgrims that are passing through. But oftentimes, Sena, as believers who are living in this world, we may lose sight of the world to come. And as a result, we become resident Christians rather than nomadic Christians. You know, nomadic Christians will recognize, hey, this is not permanent, so don't hold on to it. But resident Christians think about settling down. And we display some of our sense of permanence by our lifestyle choices, the homes that we live in, the money that we spend, the churches that we build, the investments we pursue, the priorities we live for. All these good things of this world, we hold on very tightly and lavish our attentions on them very, very freely. And as a result, you know, the writer here in chapter 2 will help us to understand, hey, don't do that. Life is temporary. You and I are only pilgrims. This is not the permanent place. And Jesus warned about this, you know, to his disciples. If you remember in Matthew's Gospel chapter 6, do not lay up for yourselves treasures here on earth. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures here on earth. Now, he puts all these things together, you know, in chapter 2, speaks about his journey. Then he speaks about death, which bursts the bubble. And then finally in chapter 2, he will also speak about, you know, if you were to say, a ray of light that shines through the shaft of darkness that he is living in. And that ray of light is recognizing that God is in the midst of all this and he has a purpose for our living. So once we recognize that truth, then even though life is just a breath, even though there is things to enjoy here in this world, good things of life, not the necessary, the sinful things, but we begin to see things from a different perspective. You don't hold on to this thinking that is what will give you happiness. You begin to focus your attention on God because that is our true source of pleasure. So let's look at this passage this evening, verse by verse, In verses 1 to 3, he speaks about his search, you know, for fulfillment, happiness, you know, by his search for pleasure. He says, "And I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure." And of course, the conclusion that he comes to is the futility of pleasure. Pleasure does not really satisfy. He says, the focus of this test is, I'm going to check out pleasure. Does, will pleasure give me satisfaction? Look at the words that I use there. Each word there is very important. He says, I've said to myself, I will test you. Test basically means it's like an experiment. It's a deliberate attempt to learn something from a personal experience. He says, I will put pleasure to the test. Let me see whether pleasure will really satisfy me. Okay. Yet another important word over there is, I said to myself, I will test you. Think, even in this first sentence itself, how many times he mentions I, me, and myself. So this gives us a strong sense of self-indulgence in the pursuit of his self-centered pleasure. So he chooses to make his own personal happiness the chief end of his life. He began to say, okay, I'm going to live for myself. I will enjoy my life. In other words, we can say he became a party animal. And a lot of people today who live like that, isn't it? Party animals live to party. But individuals who are focusing their lives only on pleasure, if you notice, they will have two directions. One direction will be a fun fantasy, living in a fantasy world, which will be more of pure escapism. Or the other one would be the feeding frenzy, which will lead to just selfish indulgence. In other words, an individual who's looking for pleasure can either escape, of course, today we have a lot of these virtual realities, escape into that escape world and things that will give him pleasure. Or another group will say, okay, let me eat as much as I want because that is what will give me pleasure. Eating not just food, anything else that will satisfy his appetite. And this is again, selfish indulgence. His frame of reference was, so enjoy yourself. That was his purpose. He says the purpose of experimentation to find out whether I will really get enjoyment out of this. Now, if you notice, the marketing world, the ad world, often has all these phrases, isn't it? Just do it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. If it feels good, do it. All these ads are basically saying, enjoy yourself here on earth, because that is what you are created for. That is why you are here on earth, so that you can have a good time. But what is the conclusion that Solomon reached? He said, then behold, it too was futility. It too was futility. Remember, pleasure does not really satisfy. So then in verse 2, if you notice, he says, okay, let's experiment with comedy. He says in verse 2, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now, if you notice, a lot of people use comedy as an entertainment, to escape from life, escape from reality. When they feel insecure, they make a joke about something. When they get down on themselves, they make fun of other people. When they are bored, they look for something to give them that that high feeling of pleasure. Or they may be looking at some, short clips. YouTube videos has plenty. They want to watch, television, funny video clips, just to make them laugh so that they forget reality. Forget reality. And oftentimes, when you read the autobiography of comedians, they are often the most loneliest and the most saddest people in the world. A lot of people use comedy, use laughter, simply as a means of anesthetizing themselves against the pain of reality. I'm sure you remember Robin Williams, who tragically committed suicide, and a comedian who worked with him, a man by the name of Jim Norton, published an opinion piece in Time magazine, and this is what he said. He said, the funniest people I know seem to be the ones surrounded by darkness. And that's probably why they are the funniest. The deeper the pit, the more humor you need to dig yourself out. The book of Ecclesiastes is a warning that laughter can never get you out of the pit. Remember in the last chapter, he says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And then he says in that verse, he says, and instead of laughter, it is madness. Now here, mad does not mean to be out of one's mind. Nah? That's the way we would use it today. But the word mad over here is speaking about something sinful. It indicates a moral perversity rather than mental oddity. And if you notice, a lot of laughter, a lot of jokes, a lot of comedies today are morally perverse, isn't it? Not all of them, but a lot of them are like that. God wants us to have joyful laughter that brings glory to God. But a lot of joking today, a lot of laughter today is frivolous and superficial, or else even cynical and sarcastic and even cruel. God wants us to enjoy life, but God wants us to honor God. And we must ask ourselves, you know, whether our laughter is rejoicing in the goodness of God or is coming at someone else's expense. Remember, life is no laughing matter. Some people may laugh all their way to the grave, but there's nothing funny about the deathbed of someone who dies without Christ. You may try to enjoy life by laughter and comedy, trying to hide the hurts within, trying to make sure that you don't face the reality of life, that life is just a vapor. And you're saying, okay, now I know that is true, but you know, I want to have a good life. I don't want to think about that, you know. Be careful, because one day you have to face the reality. Then he says, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely. Okay, he tried in a pleasure, he tried in a laughter. Now he says, and I went on a feeding frenzy. Okay, the next pleasure he tried was alcohol to escape from his troubles. Okay, it's like he found a lubricant for his laughter. Okay, now one of the main reasons people pursue pleasure is because life is short. You know, oftentimes, you know, people want to drown their sorrows, you know, which they are facing in life, with all these external things. Also, on the other hand, some people will say, why think about all these, you know, philosophical issues of life being short and death, you know, is a certainty. Forget about all that, you know. Either drown your sorrows or enjoy yourself with, you know, whatever the world has to offer, which will make you happy. But he says, you know, after all that, you know, what is the verdict? He says, until I could see what good is there for the sons of men to do under the heaven the few years of his life. You know, he says, in spite of the wine that I had, remember King, you know, Solomon had the best of everything, isn't it? He had the most choicest food, he had the very best wine, and he had the most gifted entertainers. But when the party was over, when he examined his heart, he was still dissatisfied and empty. Pleasure and laughter and mirth are only vanity. They are like soap bubbles that quickly burst and nothing is left behind. Now, why does pleasure fail to satisfy? Why does pleasure fail to satisfy? Couple of important reasons. For one thing, pleasure seeking usually becomes a selfish endeavor. Selfish endeavor. You're looking for pleasure for yourself, and oftentimes it can be at the cost of another person. And selfishness does definitely destroy true joy. Selfishness destroys true joy. People who live for pleasure often exploit others to get what they want, and they may end up with broken relationships as well as empty hearts. God wants us to have pleasure, but God wants us to be individuals who are seeking God's pleasure and seeking the pleasure of others, not for selfish ends, but what can bring joy to the heart of God and what can bring joy to people around us. Secondly, if you live for pleasure alone, enjoyment will decrease unless the intensity of the pleasure increases. It's reaching a point of diminishing returns where there is little or no enjoyment at all, and you're only addicted to that. You know, for example, the more that people drink, the less enjoyment they get out of it, and the more harder stuff they want to get that higher kick, as it were. And they are not really satisfied. Satisfaction is never reached, no? Because the more pleasure they are seeking doesn't satisfy. They want more in different other ways as well. The third reason why pleasure can never bring satisfaction is that it appeals to only one part of the person and ignores the total being. You know, there's a big difference between entertainment and true enjoyment. And the question we must ask ourselves is, you know, are you living for entertainment or are you living for enjoyment? True enjoyment comes from God. True pleasure not only brings delight, but it also brings character by enriching the total person. But entertainment only helps a person to escape life temporarily. What do you do with your time? It's an important question we must ask ourselves. You know, are you living for entertainment as a, you know, want to escape the realities of life? Or are you really seeking for true enjoyment? Yes, life is fleeting. Yes, life is a breath. But God does give us true enjoyment here on earth if our focus on Him is clear. Now in verses 4 to 8, He suddenly turns and begins to think about work, management, projects, getting things done, you know. And then He comes to this conclusion about the futility of possessions, you know. The futility of possessions, you know. Now, oftentimes people have this phrase, the man with the largest number of toys wins, you know. Nothing about it, because it's not true. You may have all the possessions that you have amassed here on earth, but when a person dies, nothing can be taken from him. So let's look at now what are the things that he began to amass, what are the things he began to work on, which he thought would give him satisfaction. And we must examine this and also find out whether in the world that we live in, with all its focus, are we somehow succumbing to this pressure to find satisfaction in these things. First of all, he was a master in architecture. He says, I enlarged my works in verse 4. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. Okay. Look at the emphasis again over there. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. Okay. This is all selfish desire, isn't it? Selfish desire. Remember, he built a lot of structures when he was king. And his own home took around 13 to 14 years to construct, okay? Even though, the temple took only, around 7 years, his own house, his own palace took around 13 to 14 years to construct. Why did he spend so much of time on that? Maybe it was like Nebuchadnezzar, when he looked at all that he had and said, look what I have done, look what I have built. And oftentimes, people spend all their time and energy in all these constructions of their homes and possessions so that they can think, a man's life consists in the abundance of the things that he possesses, so that he can look around at all that he surveys and says, look what I have done, look what I have built, that mentality. But you know what happened to Nebuchadnezzar when he had that mentality? The Lord brought him down. So that doesn't really satisfy. He thought that all this buildings would give him that satisfaction. But after spending such a lavish house to live in, after spending 14 years to build that house, at the end of it all, work was over. Nothing was left. There was only emptiness in his life. And that's oftentimes what happens, isn't it? You think this project will give you satisfaction. But once the project is over, what happens? That's the emptiness. And then maybe you have to start another project. There is no end to it. Then he thinks about horticulture. In verses 4 to 6, we read about how he decided to maintain gardens and manage them. Now, it is interesting, you know, the word that is used there for gardens or for parks, you know, the Greek word is paradisim, which is what we call as paradise, isn't it? You know? So, in a Near Eastern culture, luxurious gardens were characteristic of royalty and nobility. Okay, so he says, okay, let me focus my attention on the landscape now. Let me focus my attention on gardening. The first thing that he did was, I planted vineyards for myself. Again, remember this, for myself, okay? So that he could indulge his taste for wine, so that he could have the best possible drinks. Again, selfish reason. He could have had better reasons for gardening, but his purpose for gardening was so that he can get the best wine. Secondly, he says, I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. These were like natural beauty. And instead of, again, thanking God for his creation, because no matter how much you put effort into gardening, finally the yield is from God, isn't it? Remember, there's no paradise if God is not present. So he thought that gardening will give him that satisfaction. If there is no God, then there is definitely no satisfaction. Remember, man looks on the outward appearance, isn't it? That's what the scripture tells us. But God looks on the heart. Any ability that we have to create artistic beauty is a gift from God, and we must be willing to direct our glory to him. So whether it is the gardening, whether maybe it's a painting, whether it's the gift that God has given to you, and you say, oh, I'm going to spend all my time and energy and focus on this art and say, hey, this is what life is all about. This is what God and satisfaction for me is all about. Remember, it is God who has given that gift. So unless we focus our attention on God and ask him what he wants us to do with that gift, we may have all the abilities, we may have all the creative abilities, but at the end of it all, it will still be useless for us. Thirdly, he decided to have irrigated forests. Okay, he says, I made ponds of water, again, for myself, from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. Okay, now, trees require water, so what did he do? Southwest of Jerusalem, in a place that is seldom visited by tourists, there exists still today vast depressions in the earth, which are still called the Pools of Solomon, which he used to water the forest of trees, which he planted in an effort to find satisfaction for his own heart. So he says, okay, I'm building these trees, constructing, as it were, these trees. These trees require water. From where am I going to get the water? Again, I'm going to do this. I'm going to dig these huge ponds where I will store water and supply to these forests. Didn't satisfy. Yes, God has given us creative abilities. If you think about gardening and its beauty, yes, it gives a lot of pleasure. But if you don't recognize that God is the one who gives the yield, and God is the one who gives the life, and God is the one who has given you that ability, that creative ability, then life again would be meaningless and useless. Thirdly, he said, okay, I didn't get satisfaction there. Let me think about, being the boss, He says, I'm going to work on empire building. And he says, I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. So he not only had works, but he also had workers, okay? And some people devote their lives to climbing the ladder of power and control. Money may not be the main thing for them. What gives them pleasure is the opportunity to command others. I want to be the boss, okay? I want to be the one who's controlling everything. They think that is what will give them pleasure. Now, there's nothing wrong in running a company. There's nothing wrong in being the boss. But if you think that being the boss, being the one who has all the authority and clout, is what meaning to life is all about, that's not really the right answer. In Matthew's Gospel, chapter 20, verses 25 and 26, Jesus said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not so among you. but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. That is what true greatness is all about, and that's what true leadership is all about. That's what true authority is all about, recognizing that the authority that has been given has come from God, and you need to treat it correctly, not to throw your weight around, but to serve people. And a lot of people in this world, isn't it, who think I'm in a position of leadership so that I can throw my weight around. That is what will give me satisfaction. And when they lose the chair, when they lose that authority, when they lose that position, you know, for them, everything is lost. You know? So what's the point of living? Then, if you notice, slaves were also considered as objects of, you know, wealth. So he moves on into wealth, you know, accumulation. He says, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. You remember in those days, again, cattle, you know, was considered as, you know, the number of cattle that a person had, you know, showed the wealth that he had. So flocks and herds he accumulated. Then he also accumulated silver and gold. He says, also I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. Now remember Jesus, you know, spoke about the parable of the rich fool, isn't it, in Luke's Gospel chapter 12, where he begins to reason within himself and says, oh, I've got a good business this year and this is what I'm going to do. I'll break down my barns, build bigger barns, and I will say to myself, what? Take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. What he thought was, since he has many goods laid up for many years, he can relax. He can relax. But what did God say? He says, you fool, you know, I require your life tonight. Then what will happen to all these goods that you have possessed? You know? So you can have all your possessions, but if our security is in our wealth and possessions, you know, when death comes knocking on the door, we would be the most saddest individuals. What happens when the projects that give us satisfaction is over? What happens, you know, when the success that we thought will give us satisfaction is over? What happens when we think that being the boss, you know, would give us satisfaction and you are no longer the boss? What will happen? It was Henry Ward Beecher who said, you know, this, success is full of promise until men get it. And then it is a last year's nest from which the birds have flown. Journey could be a pleasure, but the destination can definitely bring pain. Now we must remember over here that what Solomon was saying is he's not saying that, you know, work is bad. No, remember, work is not part of the curse. Oftentimes people think, you know, that work is a curse. No, no. Adam and Eve had started working even before the curse. Work is a blessing from God. But work alone cannot satisfy the human heart. Work alone cannot satisfy the human heart. Oftentimes, you know, people get their identity from their work, and when they lose their job, you know, they lose their identity. No, we don't get our identity from our work. We get our identity from our relationship with God. And the overachiever is often a person who's trying to escape himself or herself by being a workaholic. And oftentimes, this only leads in disappointment. And when a workaholic retires, you know, and he has no work, and sometimes they die very soon after retirement because, you know, there was nothing that they needed to do or had to do. Now, so work does not really satisfy him. Then he says, okay, you know, let me provide for myself male and female singers. He says, okay, if all this doesn't satisfy, let me go through entertainment. Entertainment. In our society has adopted primarily the entertainment pleasure culture, isn't it? We live to play. We work to be able to finance our playing. And we often live for the weekend. The money that we accumulate, we want to use it to entertain ourselves. That's our goal. And a lot of times people are waiting for the weekend to come to give themselves over to pleasure and entertainment. Now remember, our goal, you know, should not be to insulate ourselves from the pain of reality, to numb ourselves and to distract ourselves from the harsh realities of life by immersing ourselves in all these pleasure-giving activities, entertainment which will give us momentary pleasures, momentary taking our minds off from reality. But no, we must face up to the reality. We must learn not to insulate ourselves, but to draw our strength from God, so that in the world that we live in the shortness of life, we can really, truly enjoy life and enjoy God. Sixthly, he spoke about now, and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Okay, he says all these things didn't satisfy. So I said, okay, then I said, maybe sexual pleasure will satisfy him. You know, now it's interesting, if we read in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 3, he says, we find he had 700 wives, 700 wives, 300 concubines. Okay, think of it. 100 women or 1,000 women, okay? He thought that will give them his satisfaction, you know. 1,000 women all around him to give him sexual satisfaction. He, you know, sort of viewed them as, you know, something to collect, as it were, as objects of pleasure to indulge in his physical, you know, appetites. There was no relationship or companionship over here. This was more treating women as objects for his own pleasure. And that's what the world that we live in here, isn't it? You know, the world begins to treat, you know, the women for the pleasure point of view, to treat them as objects. But they find that the more they do it, they are never really satisfied. And then it leads further and further and further. And that's where all the different crimes that are being committed happens around today. Why? Because the starting point itself was wrong. They did not view women as created in God's image, but they viewed women as created as sexual objects for male pleasure. And when that does not satisfy, they are definitely upset. What are the snares of pleasure? Number one, pleasure always promises more than it can produce. The more you hunt for pleasure, the less of it you will find. The more you hunt, the less of it you will find. And oftentimes this is in a very simply seen, where people can keep flicking their remotes to find something that will give them pleasure. In spite of so many channels around, they still find no pleasure. Secondly, pleasure satisfies only during the act itself. Only during the act itself. In other words, pleasure does, you know, satisfy just for that moment. But if you notice, you know, the world will say, hey, look here, you're satisfied once. Hey, have another one. Have another one. Remember a couple of years back, you know, the Lay's potato chips had this ad which said, you know, you can't just eat just one. Okay. The act of eating for pleasure is not satisfied just by having one chip. You know, say, have more, have more, have more. You are never going to be satisfied. And this act of eating for pleasure without hunger and often to excess, there's a name for that. It's called hedonic hyperphagia. Okay. And people are finding out why people eat and eat and eat to give them pleasure, but they are never really satisfied. They're trying to discover reasons for that, so that maybe, you know, they can do some brain activity to cut that off. Remember, there's always the danger of coming under something which will control us. Whether it's the eating, whether it's the pleasure, you know, something else that will control us. And that is what addiction is all about. You know, why? Because they think they will get pleasure, not satisfied, move further, move further. They have got addicted to it. And once addiction sets in, they cannot come out of it. And you know, they are just bored with pleasure. That's the third thing, you know, we get bored. And as I mentioned last time, we are living in an age where, in spite of so much that is available that man can do in a concrete manner, a lot of, you know, children and youth will say, I don't know what to do with my time. I'm bored, you know, I get bored very easily. And today, because of the short attention span of people, people want things to be given in just those short 1 second, 2 second, 1 minute bites, you know. More than that, they get bored. Fourthly, if you don't get bored, you get frustrated. It was William Shakespeare who made that statement. If all the years were playing holidays, to sport would be as tedious as to work. In other words, if life was just a holiday, you would actually be working on your holiday, And that's an important thing to look at, because too much, of something will definitely going to make you feel frustrated. As the book of Proverbs says, too much honey makes you sick, okay? Then, in verse 9, he says, then I became great. Okay, he tried all this, so he says, okay, now I'm going to try something else. I'm going to have an ambition in life, And that ambition led him to I am somebody. The futility of pride and selfish ambition, the pursuit of greatness. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. I'm sure by this time he was getting a big head, but he didn't completely, lose touch with reality. He says, the Hebrews a lot more forcefully put where it says, I was great and I added to my greatness. English it says, then I became great and increased more than all. So here it says, I was great, and I added to my greatness. That was my desire. I'm already on that top position. I'm not satisfied. I want more on that, more on that. And remember, Solomon had a visit from the Queen of Sheba. He also had visits from other dignitaries. Why did he encourage all that? Because he wanted to show people all that he had. He was a man pleaser and not a God pleaser. So if this is what you think will satisfy, there are a lot of people here on earth who do that, isn't it? They're living for others, or they're living to show others what they have got so that they would be in a higher position. That does not really satisfy. And this is the formula, if you were to say, for spiritual disaster. In verse 10, he says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. In other words, the eyes, which are the outward aspects of his pleasure, the heart, which were the inward aspects of his pleasure, he said, I did not give a break. Whatever I saw, I wanted. Whatever my heart desired, I wanted. I thought this is what will really give me satisfaction. But it did not really work out. And the Bible tells us very clearly in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, men will be lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. When? In the last days that we live in. And we are living in an age where people are living only to enjoy life, only to enjoy life. Amos 6 tells us, woe to those who are at ease in Zion, who recline on beds of ivory. A lot of people, when they think about retirement, they are thinking about an endless vacation. Times when they can now just relax and enjoy life because of all the hard work they have done. John Piper has written a very interesting short book called Rethinking Retirement. If you find the time, please read it. Because that's a good book, for those who have in that retirement stage. If you are thinking, hey, now I can relax, I can enjoy life. Enjoy life in what way? God has given his gifts to us so that we can use it for his glory, not for our own selfish pleasures. And that's an important lesson that we must learn. Verse 10, he says, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. He says, yes, I got my reward. What is the reward? It was a fleeting pleasure. Yes, it gave me satisfaction, but it was only for the moment. Remember, when you live for the pleasures of today, you're left with a handful of smoke instead of rewards for eternity. So he comes to this conclusion in verse 11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had laid and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. There was only a bitter disillusionment. Then in the next verse he says, okay, then the morning after, okay, then a morning after I considered these things, okay. Now, the word that is used there for consider in Greek literally means to face, you know, means to look somebody right in the eye. So what Solomon is doing here is, he says, okay, I did all this pleasure, then I considered, I stopped for a moment and looked in the eye of all these things that I had experienced. And then I came to the conclusion that it is of no use whatsoever. It's good once in a way to consider, isn't it? To face up with the reality, you know, look it in the eye, take stock of your life and find out, are you really enjoying life or are you really only entertaining yourself? Then verses 12 to 17, he says, you know, now he turns from another side. He says, okay, you know, these things, pleasure did not give me satisfaction. So I turn to consider wisdom. I turn to consider wisdom. You know, he saw things from another perspective. Okay. And what did he see? Hey, there were some advantages of wisdom. And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. He came to the conclusion, hey, there are some advantages of wisdom. If a person is wise in his eyes, you know, he's able to walk properly. He has some direction. But if he is a fool, he's only living in darkness. But he also realized the futility of wisdom because he said, the same fate awaits them both. In verse 14, he says, yet I know that one fate befalls them both. What is that? Death. Death is every man's destiny. Death is every man's destiny. So he looked at all these things and he said, somewhere there's one shadow that is constantly following me all along. Okay. And that is death. I cannot, you know, I cannot escape it. I cannot escape it. He says, yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. That is what wisdom taught him. When he looked it in the face, he says, you know, at the end of it all, it's going to be death, you know. So I have to face up to death. And the certainty of death is a topic that Solomon frequently mentions in the book of Ecclesiastes. And remember, only that person is prepared to live who is prepared to die. Let me say it again. Only that person is prepared to live who is prepared to die. That's why we have said living life backwards, living in the light of eternity. When we know that death ends it all, then it gives us a realization, how should we then live? How should we then live? It was Blaise Pascal who argued, as men have not been able to cure death, misery, or ignorance, they have taken to not thinking about them so as to become happy. We refuse to think about these things, you know. Why? Because if we are thinking about death and misery and ignorance, you know, then it will make us, you know, not happy. So he says, why talk about death? Even though death is the only certain thing in life, very few people actually sit and think about death and think about how to prepare for it. Now, two reasons why pursuing wisdom is worthless. In verse 15, he says, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. So why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, you know, this too is vanity. He's saying, pursuing wisdom is worthless because it cannot change man's destiny. Because a person is wise, that doesn't mean he's not going to die. He's still going to die. Whether he's a wise or a fool, he's still going to die. So he says, hey, what's the point then of being wise? Secondly, pursuing wisdom is worthless because it cannot build a redeeming, lasting legacy. Verse 16 says, there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man. There is no lasting remembrance of the wise man. So he says, you know, if I was wise, if I thought through life, if I prepared well, and I also have to die, and then after I die, nobody is going to think about me. What's the point? What's the point, you know? So his conclusion, which was a very frustrating conclusion in verse 17, we read, so I hated life. So I hated life. Now, that doesn't mean that he was contemplating suicide because death was one thing he wanted to avoid. And it was a French atheist, humanist, you know, Voltaire, who made this statement, I hate life and yet I am afraid to die. I hate life and yet I am afraid to die. And that's the thought of a lot of people, isn't it? You know, they are going through all the frustrations of life. They hate life. They are disgusted with life. But still they don't want to die, you know. They don't want to die, you know, because they don't know what is going to happen. They cannot face death, you know. But remember, a healthy Christian believer would not hate life, no matter how difficult the circumstances may be. You and I are called to love life because the scripture tells us our labor is not vain in the Lord, because life does not end with death. There is life after death, okay. Then he moves on further in verses 18 to 23 about the futility of work, the futility of work. The reality of death hits him, okay? And then he says, okay, what is going to happen to all my achievements, you know? What's going to happen to all my possessions, you know? And although he's a wise man, when he says, all these riches are going to fall into the lap of a fool, you know? So this is the thought that he comes across. He has given his mind to it. Okay, remember, he's faced death. He's given his mind to it. And he's coming up with these words of wisdom, where he says, you know, if at the end of it all, I've got a good job, I've got a good pay package, I've got all my good possessions, you know, and I'm looking forward to leave a lasting legacy, what happens? You know, I have to leave it to somebody who's going to squander it. You know, what then? You know, what's the point? That's a question he asks. So five reasons he gives us in these verses why he was disgusted with wealth. Number one, in verse 18, you know, we can't keep it. We can't keep it. You're not going to keep it forever. One day you're going to face death. Now, the sad thing is, because we have not yet seen heaven, we fail to appreciate the riches that God has in store for us. So we are working on riches, sinner, here on earth. Now, we don't have any idea. The Bible tells us, eye has not seen, neither has ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man, the things that God has in store for those who love him. If only we get a glimpse about that, you know, as people often say, if there are streets of gold in heaven, why are people accumulating gold here on earth as if it is something expensive? Now, if we get the true perspective of the reality, then what is happening here on earth, we are not going to actually hold on to it, because we can't keep it forever. Secondly, money is only a medium of exchange, okay? Unless it is spent, it cannot do anything for you. Remember, you can't eat money. You have to use it to buy food, you know? And this is something that we must recognize. If a person is only hoarding and hoarding and hoarding, what happens? Suddenly demonetization happens and all his currencies that he had is of useless, you know. Or, you know, something has happened, it's been stolen, or moths have eaten, rats have eaten. Hoarding money is not really going to help. Money has to be used, okay. And a writer in the Wall Street Journal called money an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven. Except heaven. And a universal provider of everything except happiness. Remember, this is a Wall Street Journal and a writer mentioning this. And a universal passport to everywhere except heaven. Thirdly, we can't protect it. We can't protect it. You know, we cannot say, okay, I'm going to make sure that, you know, my children, my children's children, you know, they're all going to use it properly. We can't put any, you know, sort of rules and regulations, isn't it? You know, so what will happen? You know, what will happen? You know, if we leave it to somebody who will waste it, who will waste it? You know, what's the point? What's the point? He says, the man who will come after me. Okay, it's rather a strange way to describe his son, isn't it? But remember, David and Solomon, you know, what is the type of relationship they had? And what about Solomon and Rehoboam? Did they have a strong relationship? Rehoboam squandered everything that he had, his father had built up, isn't it? And even when you're thinking about David and Solomon, Solomon was nowhere close to like David was, isn't it? David was a rich person. Solomon inherited that riches. What did he do with all that riches, you know? built houses for his concubines and squandered that money away. Fourthly, you don't get any return on your investment. So he says in verse 20, therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. So he says, I'm not going to get any returns forever. You know, I may get some returns on my investments here on earth, you know, but after I die, what investments, you know, what returns am I going to get if my succeeding generations are going to misuse it? So in verse 21, you know, to 23, he gives us yet another reason. He says, we can't enjoy it as we should. We can't enjoy it as we should. He says, is that fair? We spend days in travail and grief and have many sleepless nights, yet our heirs never experience any of this. It all seems so futile. He says, we have worked hard, blood, sweat, and tears. We have accumulated all that money. Next generation, they have just inherited it and, you know, they have just squandered it. You know, what's the point? What's the point? You know, now the Japanese, by the way, have a name for this rat race, you know, of getting more and getting more, working hard, getting more. And the word that they use in Japanese is the word karoshi, which means death by overwork. Death by overwork. So if a person is an owner, overwork achiever, thinking that, you know, labor will work, you know, will give him his satisfaction, money will give him his satisfaction, possessions will give him his satisfaction, Solomon bursts that bubble and says, hey, one day death will come knocking on your door. And what's going to happen to all that? You know, he says he will be frustrated with life, frustrated with life. Okay, you know, what shall it profit? So in verse 24, in closing, if you notice, you know, there's a big transition now. Okay, God is now in view. God is now in view. And this is the first of the six conclusions, as it were. Six conclusions, okay? He does, you know, burst the bubble, you know, by making this statement in verse 24. He says, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil, okay? Now, initially, when you look at this verse, it may, you know, and I look at, hey, what is he saying? Is he saying that you must, you know, enjoy life here? No, no, what he's really saying is the conclusion that he has come to is that, you know, the importance of accepting life as God's gift and enjoying it in God's will. Death reorients us to our limitations as his creatures and helps us to see God's good gifts right in front of us all of our lives. And instead of using these gifts as a means to a greater end of some gain in this world, we take time to live inside the gifts themselves and see the hand of God in it. So Solomon is not saying eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Rather, he's saying thank God for what you do have and enjoy it to the glory of God. So he makes it clear that these blessings were from God. Even the enjoyment of blessings is a gift that God has given to us. And you know, the interesting part is that the book of Ecclesiastes was read by the Jewish people at the Feast of Tabernacles. For Tabernacles, this was a time of thanksgiving and rejoicing for God's abundant provision for their needs. So they read this book as a time of enjoyment of God's goodness in our lives. So God's goods, gifts are good and should be enjoyed with thanksgiving. These are good gifts that God has given to us. So what Solomon is saying over here, who can really have true enjoyment without God? Without God. And as God's people, we are the ones who should truly be enjoying life. Do you know that? By the way, the word enthusiasm has two words in Greek, entheos, which means in God. So the people who are in God should be the most happiest, most interesting, most enthusiastic people. Ask yourself, is that how you view life? Are you most enthusiastic because you have the relationship with God? That's what the writer is emphasizing over here. That's what true enjoyment is all about. And finally, in verse 26, he says, God's gifts ultimately flow to the righteous. You know, the sinner is punished, you know, and the righteous is benefited. There's nothing but futility for a person who does not know God. But for a person who knows God, all these good gifts that God has given to us to enjoy, we can really be enthusiastic and find true joy in Him as we seek to find ways and means by which we can use what God has given to us to bless God and to bless others as well. So Solomon has presented these four arguments, you know, that seem to prove that life is really not worth it. In chapter 1, verses 4 to 11, he spoke about the monotony of life. In chapter 1, verses 12 to 8, he spoke about the vanity of wisdom. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, he spoke about the futility of wealth. And in verses 12 to 13, he has spoken about the certainty of death. And in the next 8 chapters, Solomon will consider each of these 4 arguments and refute them. And at the end of each argument, he will say, enjoy life, be thankful to God. And this is what good living, enjoyment of life, the way God has created us to enjoy, is what life is all about. Life is not a bore. Life is full of enjoyment when it is lived in the reality of knowing God, His purpose for our lives, and making sure His name is glorified. Let me close with a couple of application questions this evening. Number 1, what is your definition of pleasure? How do you differentiate between when pleasures are legitimate for you and when they are illegitimate? Number 2, what is your answer to the question, I'll be happy when? If you had to fill out those blanks, you know, what would you put over there? Number 3, what is your motivation for getting up each morning? You get up each morning with a lot of enthusiasm. This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice in it. Are you enthusiastic because of your relationship with God? What's your motivation? Number 4, how do you view work? Do you view it as a blessing from God? Or do you view it as a way to prove yourself? Or do you think it's a burden? Or you think it's an endless ladder to climb up the ladder of success? Or do you think it's an obsession, you know, for you? Number 5, think of the workaholics you have known and list their characteristics. Why do they find it so difficult to relax and enjoy life? What do you think is motivating their drive to accomplish? And number 6, what strategies do you think people you know, including yourself, use to avoid facing the reality of death? Have you ever stopped to think about death and to face death? Considered looking at it face to face? What do you make of the idea that death can give us the perspective we need to begin to enjoy life? Let's bow our heads in prayer together.